Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp, all made safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style, and a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively to Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lore cast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect lore cast. I'm In7 the Legend.
And I'm Genesis. Join us
as we explore along tides of light
and through shoals of dust
to see where this lore began
and consider where it may go.
Spectres, welcome back to another exciting week of the Mass Effect Lorecast. I am your host, In7 the Legend, and actually I'm getting a late-breaking announcement. We are...
I am assuming direct control.
...are being assumed direct control of. That's how you would say that. Receiving our orders, so to speak. We may call them Reapers, but they call themselves... Our salvation, rather. Wow, I can't really speak today. We're off to a great start. And they demand that we talk about how it is that we humans have spread like vermin. Joining me, as always, is Genesis.
Yes, hello, hello. We are vermin. And I think this episode definitely is going to be very much about that topic, how we are very cockroach-like and expand and multiply quickly.
That's pretty true. We do multiply rather quickly, and we will get into exactly how quickly in probably the middle of this episode. So this episode is, of course, brought to you by our Reaper tier patron, Commander Shrinky Shep. I'm legally required to play this sound effect every time I say his name. And like many of us, he is skeptical of how fast humanity has been able to expand throughout the Milky Way. He also brings up to us that humanity's technology seems to have progressed way faster than the other Milky Way races. So we're going to take a look at these two claims and we're going to analyze them today. But first, Jin, I think it's good that we go over a helpful starting point to look at some key events on humanity's entrance to the galactic stage. So why don't you kick us off here?
Yeah, I also remember wondering how over 800,000 humans had already made it to Omega when we were talking about Arya and the data pad that she had with the human population list. So this should be interesting to dive a little bit more into how those people got there so fast. So we can kick off going over a little bit of the timeline here. On July 20th of 2069, humanity founded its first settlement off of Earth, this one being on the moon, and which we can go to.
That's the 100-year anniversary of the moon landing, I believe. I think so. Apollo 11? Someone correct me. July 20th, 1969.
That sounds right.
Or maybe it's the 100th anniversary of one of the Apollo missions. I can't remember which one. But yes, 34 years later, in 2103, we found the first settlement on Mars, and that's by the European Space Agency. That one is named Lowell City.
By 2148, this is the big one. This is when humanity uncovers the trove of Prothean data that leads us to discover the principles of mass effect physics. That means that we learn how to fly faster than light, greatly opening up our possibilities of where we can travel.
Right. And before we go further, I just wanted to make note that by 2183, the population on Mars, the human population, is 3.4 million. 3.4 million. So that's by 2183. That is 80 years. 80 years after it was founded. Okay, that's still a very fast population boom. But like you mentioned, the bigger deal is when we discover that Prothean data cache that kind of opens up mass effect physics, FTL travel, and it leads us to the Charon mass relay, which is hiding underneath ice in a comet near Pluto. And from there, the Alliance hero John Grissom goes through that relay to find the Arcturus system.
Oh, and Alan Unpronounceable in chat did just verify Apollo 11th was July 20th, 1969.
Hey, pew, pew. My memory served right off the cuff. I didn't write that down.
Okay, so I'll move it along here a little bit to 2150. And this is the first planetary surveys are done by the New Systems Alliance, finding Terra Nova as the first good colonization prospect.
This is kind of a big deal, right? Because within 47 years, we have gone from the first settlement on Mars to now we are talking about colonizing planets outside of our solar system. And all of this, again, is thanks to that discovery on Mars of the Prothean data cache and the discovery of mass effect physics. You have to wonder if that was intentionally left there by the Reapers, or rather an anomaly that it was just swept under dust, and because it was, and it did have to be excavated. It was a dig site. Did the Reapers just not realize it because they're programmed to look for signs of organic life, and there were none there? So, I mean, they've done a pretty good job of scrubbing archaeological sites of anything useful in other planets. But they missed that one, and that is a big deal because that accelerates human advancement very, very, very quickly. As we'll talk about a little bit later, the humans are not the only ones with that kind of advantage. But this also leads humanity, this expansion leads humanity to realize that it needs somewhat of a central nervous system in as much as the Systems Alliance. So work is done to create the Systems Alliance military, and with that, Arcturus Station being a new home for the Alliance military, and later the Alliance Parliament. It's just necessary for humanity's growing colonial ambitions that there be some kind of centralized nervous structure to kind of, or nervous system to kind of govern all, or at least defend all of it. That construction formally, The station finishes 5 years later. Construction doesn't stop until later after that. But after, even by 5 years later, by the time the station opens, by that point, humanity has already founded colonies on Demeter, on Eden Prime, on Shanxi, and Terra Nova. So at least four different planets.
Yeah, that's quite a bit in just a handful of years. But it's like, this is how fast I think we would get out there. I think that humans have been wanting to be, you know, out there in space, even like right now in the real world. We want to get out there. We want to do these things. And so I can see that definitely in a video game setting, we would do this.
What's kind of surprising to me is because you and I are both like super tuned into space news. And I think that we know enough to know that finding a Goldilocks planet that would support human habitation is so rare, and that it's a big deal whenever there's a potential one found, like through telescopes and imagery and things like that, let alone eyes on, boots on the ground. So it's shocking to me that within that amount of time, they've already found four suitable planets for human habitation. Is that basically a testament to human ingenuity in terms of like terraforming and environmental engineering, that our technology is that good that we can create these biosuits, that we can create these habitats that would withstand these different planets? Or rather, did we just get extremely lucky? Because Eden Prime and Terra Nova, I know at least, those are naturally like, you don't have to wear a helmet there.
I do agree that it probably is a little bit of the technology boost that came with this, because right now we can see quite a bit, and we know what planets are in the next solar system, things like that. But that doesn't mean that we can necessarily tell what the actual ground would be like. Is that air breathable? Can we do anything to help change it? And we also do find several planets that are not going to be habitable for humans. The one that we talked about with the Batarians, about how they were able to terraform it for them, but we couldn't do that for us because it would have been way too big of an expenditure.
I don't know, though, because humanity privatized a lot of this space exploration and colonization effort. So the cost would really be spread out among several different corporations like Eldfeld Ashland. Seems like they might have the money, at least to put toward R&D for some of this stuff. But all of this is really before humans even have any biotics, right?
Yeah, because 2151, the same year that we started construction on Arcturus, was also the year that the Singapore incident happened and the first exposure to Ezo took place. So humans didn't have biotics by the time that we were building Arcturus. My Caden was in utero at that point, and he was born in 2152, just a year later.
Let's see, how dead will I be by 2152? I'll be pretty fucking dead. that's my formal assessment of that. It's, yeah.
You could have grandbabies.
I'll be like 70 or 80 years dead probably by that point. So, yeah, maybe my grandkids will be alive. So, anyway, that's crazy. The Singapore incident basically being the catalyst, no pun intended, for all of human advancement with biotics. And I just want to stop right here because 2152, about 87 years, humanity has gone from its first colony off of Earth on the moon to now having spread into at least two more solar systems. At the point that they had settled on the moon, it was still physically impossible for humanity to realistically found a colony on another system. And before someone gets cheeky and brings up the Victor Mansell expedition, keep in mind, I am considering that. But it took them so long to get to their Alpha Centauri that they had not settled by this point. And they weren't even discovered by Asari researchers for like way longer. So it's just amazing that technological discovery in 2148 on Mars allowed humanity to jumpstart its colonization to two more solar systems with realistically a workable span of about 30 years.
Okay, dropping it down to about the 30 to 40 year range does make it kind of crazy that we're in at least two more solar systems. Because looking at it in like 87 years is a very long time. I mean, that's a human lifetime. And I know that in my human lifetime of only 38 years, technology has drastically changed. I'm not listening to 8-tracks in my car, you know? Think about how much technology has changed there in just that. So, you know, it's possible that technology could have boosted this far this fast.
True. I'm considering what Alan brings up here in chat is that to travel below the speed of light and to travel at the speed that humanity was likely traveling relatively before that discovery in 2148, to even try and think about getting to another solar system with the same crew of astronauts is so unlikely it's almost impossible. So it is remarkable that Mars discovery really kicking things off here. Humanity kind of lucked out there, because imagine if the Mars archives weren't on Mars, they were on Titan. Or what if they were on Neptune, like orbiting Uranus, maybe, for the meme factor.
Nice.
That would delay, I think, that would delay humanity's expansion by maybe like a dozens of years, if not decades. Because if they're getting to Mars, how much harder and longer and logistically speaking, how much more difficult is it going to be to get to Titan or to Neptune or Uranus or Pluto with no guarantee that there's anything there? Is anyone going to fund that expedition?
That's true. I also fully agree with that. And I think that it being placed on Mars was, you know, being geographically blessed. You know, but it's like anything closer to the sun, maybe the Protheans didn't have the time or the technology to terraform one of our planets to get it to where their things would last. So maybe Mars was their Goldilocks at this point.
True. True. We don't know what Mars was like when they were around, I think. However, we do know that they did choose Mars because of its proximity to Earth. It made it a good kind of launch point to observe human evolution. So, okay, so we left off 2152. Just 6 years after that, Arcturus is built. Just 6 years after Arcturus is built, we get first contact with the Turians. So 2157, first contact war, doesn't go well. You can find more info on that war in one of our first episodes, which we should probably re-record. My sound quality has gotten drastically better, I think, since then. And for anyone who started with the first several episodes of the Lorecast, I apologize that you had to go through Volus in Seven Legend.
Don't you mean Volus Kung Fu Kangaroo?
Volus Kung Fu. Wow, that's... You hit me with that one live. Okay. I haven't... That's a name I haven't gone by in 87 years. You know what the stupid thing is? And I don't know if I've said this live before. I think I've always talked about this on Discord and whatnot. My name was in Seven the Legend on Xbox for like ever. And then I started the Lorecast with Tom. And for some reason, I was like, oh yeah, I should probably change names. Despite the fact that in Seven Legend was perfect for the Mass Effect Lorecast. So I went by Kung Fu Kangaroo. And then I was like, well, why the hell did I do that? So I switched back to N7 Legend. But by that point, N7 Legend was taken, so I had to put in the. It used to be N7 Legend, then it became N7 The Legend, because I refused to put numbers in my gamer tags. Anyway, that's a little bit of lore about me. That's beside the point. We know that from the lore of humanity... that we basically still had 20th century weapons by the time the First Contact War rolled around. And that humanity tried to fight the Turians, got their ass kicked, and lost Shanxi briefly, but humanity wasn't going to back down, and then there's an admiral launches a surprise attack and takes back the colony of Shanxi. That wasn't going to be the end of it. The council stepped in and stopped the Turians from going balls to the wall and annihilating humanity. They were ready for a full-scale invasion. But in so doing, the council reveals the presence of the galaxy's intelligent, more advanced races.
Absolutely. So we know that the First Contact War was a key event in 2157, and that causes huge ripple effects in basically every human action moving forward. The events of Mass Effect Evolution also take place in this year timeframe, which creates the identity of the elusive man and also found Cerberus.
Yeah, it is the basis for basically all of his and Cerberus, their organization, Xenophobia.
Exactly. In 2158, we learn that the children exposed to Element Zero have the potential for biotic abilities. So it took time, even after that initial exposure, for us to learn what happens from that. And on April 14th of that year, Ashley Williams was born.
Heyo. All right. Nice. April 14th, a date that will live in fame. Nice.
I brought up Caden. I figured I'd bring up Ashley, too.
Of course. And Caden, being one of those children exposed to Element Zero, was he exposed specifically in the Singapore incident? I can't remember.
He was. Yeah, his mother is Singaporean.
Okay. Well, that would be why we have biotic Caden, with his headaches and all. The next year, the Alliance purchases Gagarin Station, right? I think that's how it's pronounced.
I think so.
Yeah. Gagarin Station, and converts it into a biotic research and training facility. Gagarin Station used to be the furthest human-made structure from Earth until the discovery of the Charon Relay, and it was known as Jump Zero. But that also brings us back to Headache Boy.
It does. It does. Because in 2160, the System's Alliance Parliament is formed and the BOT program is established at Jump Zero, where they started all of their biotic training and where Caden killed a Turian.
There is some context there, okay? He didn't just murder him.
This is true. There was context involved, but it eventually boils down to Caden killed a Turian.
Okay, so basically we've now crossed about nine years from the Singapore incident to now we have like an industrial system set up to train human biotics. That was in 9 years. So even the very first babies like Caden are nine by the time that Brain Camp is set up.
No, there's got to be some math wrong because Caden was 16 when he entered BOT.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm pretty sure my math is right, that 2160 minus 2151 is 9.
Whoa. Okay.
Okay, we can chalk this up that next.
That doesn't mean that Caden was in the first class of BOT.
Correct.
He could have gone in years later.
Correct. He likely went in years later. But let's also chalk that up next to like Presley saying that his grandfather served in the Greek in the First Contact War. Bro, you look like you're 60 something. How old is your grandfather? Like, I thought he was friends with Henry Ford. Fuck. So 2162, the construction of Arcturus Station finally completed. And you have here in the notes that we are babies. We are babies in the galactic timeline.
Yeah. We just learned about biotics a few years ago, and we are still babies in the eyes of the council and everybody.
Yeah.
No, we haven't even met the council yet, have we?
No. Well, we have, because the council stepped in to intervene to kind of bring a peace to the First Contact War, or the Relay 314 incident, as the Turians put it. And it's just a few years later that we see more and more and more human colonies expanding from Earth. They are growing their trade alliances with many other species who recognize the Citadel Council as the ruling authority. So this led the Council to officially recognize humanity's growing power and influence in the galactic community, and they're granted an embassy on the Citadel. This is something that comes up in one of the very first conversations in Mass Effect 1 when you're walking around the embassies as Shepard, and you go to Din Korlak, and is it Zeltan? I can't remember the Zeltan, the Elcor. Din is pissed off that humanity was given an embassy so quickly that they seem to have gotten this political recognition, this political power by 2165. So that was just within 8 years. 8 years, humanity is granted that kind of political power, whereas other races have had to wait, factors of multitude higher than that.
Yeah, and the fact that Udina's office is so big in comparison to the Elcor's office. I'm sorry, the Elcor should have a pretty damn big office. I think just physically, they are way bigger. They deserve a bigger space.
And we even get that remark from the one human diplomat, which is my favorite background NPC of all time. Like, I can't believe I landed a job here. Props if anyone knows exactly who I'm talking about, but that little remark is a little bit of flavor text because she looks to be like in her 30s, maybe 40s, and she already got a job with the human embassy on the Citadel. Like, wow. Like, not only are we as a species progressing very quickly, but that lady is doing very well for herself in what is a brutal job market.
Yeah, unless personal connections were already established and built, and Udina just plucked her from the pool of people.
It's true. It's probably fucking nepotism. But
nepotism.
So you can understand then that why all of these other races are so, like, there's such this tension between humanity and the other races about humanity being the new kid on the block, and they're getting all this cool stuff for free, it looks like.
Yeah. So over the next 10 years or so, there are a lot of little things that happen and, you know, but not anything that would help to explain the expansion of humans throughout space. But I did want to say by the expansion continues and by 2176, the Andromeda Initiative is founded to even further explore the universe. So not that long. Within 10 years, or what is that, 12 years? 11. Within 11 years of us getting a...
embassy?
A spot. Yeah, an embassy. We've now started the Andromeda Initiative because that wasn't good enough for us. We want more.
And I think we actually missed something. I think it was in the 2160s. Humanity is that's when the Mass Effect Revelation starts, with humanity conducting that illegal AI research on Sidon. Yes. So the memory of the Geth and the Quarians is still fresh in the galaxy's memory. And yet humanity is conducting more illegal AI research on Sidon. And it's like an alliance facility that goes totally awry thanks to a Batarian named Idan Hada. Ultimately, Saren gets involved. Go read Mass Effect Revelation for more details because it is great. But by 2183, this is like when Mass Effect 1 starts, and it's also a really good comparison point because this is when we have all of our data from those planet cards and the codex. So by 2183, the population on Eden Prime, 3.7 million. The population on Terra Nova, 4.4 million. The population on Mars, like we mentioned earlier, 3.4 million. We're looking at, like, what, 10 million just there alone?
It would be interesting to kind of look at the data of, like, what a country size is right now and compare it. Because I know that the population of the United States is around 300 million. And then, so what country has just completely moved off planet?
Lesotho.
Okay.
I don't think that there's 10 million.
Wait a minute.
Lesotho. No, but there's like 11 billion people on Earth, I think, by the time Mass Effect 1 rolls around. So it's not like unbelievable that 10 million could already spread amongst the stars. What the most unbelievable part of that for me is the logistics of it. Getting that many people off Earth and to that destination. Like, ships only hold hundreds of people max, unless you're talking about ARC ships with Andromeda Initiative, but we didn't have those.
That is definitely a good logistical question. I mean, I think maybe I'm only picturing like our current military ships that we see in the game, and those would only be hundreds of people. But there has to be some form of transport that is going to carry thousands, if not more.
I mean, I only know of those like merchant vessels that we board. Like Ripper Talk here in chat says, maybe they started a space bus service. Maybe, who knows? Maybe there's some other kind of ship vessel type that we're not aware of. But as far as I know, even with the Corian live ship sizes, this would take a while. Like getting, because the live ships can't land on planets, right? You need to ferry people to and from the live ships. So this is a massive logistical effort. And the most impressive part of Eden Prime and Terra Nova being 3.7 and 4.4 million is that this is just 31 years after these colonies were founded.
Okay. Well, then I could also see an actual, like, an effort being made by the Alliance Systems Parliament in order to be like, this is what we are doing. Even if it is running ships 24/7 with as many people as we can, we're going to get as many people out there off world.
Let's just do the math real quick. All right. 3.7 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 3.7 million. And we're going to divide that by 31 years, right? That's 119,000 people per year.
Okay.
You divide that by 365, and we will get how many per day. They were literally bringing in, that's almost unbelievable. They're bringing in 327 people per day, every day.
Knock off a little bit for people who were born on Eden Prime.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That does sound a little outlandish when it's broken down to the how many people by day.
Right. Every day. And that's not, like, think about Terra Nova. So 4.4 million. Let's do the math there. 4.4 million, 31 years. 142,000 per year. That is 389 people per day. That's a lot of people per day, not counting, of course, like you mentioned, the people who were born there. And of course, growth grows exponentially. However, humanity now has dozens of colonies spread out across multiple systems. Those are just two. And we also have a military rivaling the Salarians and the Asari, but still second to the Turian hierarchy, though it is projected to soon challenge it in overall strength by Mass Effect 1. Even so, our military is strong enough to consistently push back the Batarians, defeating an established race, an alien race with no help from the Council, an alien race who has been on the scene longer than us, and who has had access to technology greater than ours. And we're doing this in the Traverse with no help from the Council. I'm sorry, in the Scyllian Verge. With no help from the Council.
Chalk it up to human ingenuity?
Right. There's a little bit of writing magic going on here, I think. But keep in mind, too, that this is only 26 years after being introduced to the galactic economy. And so I remember one of the coolest lessons I learned in anthropology class was that one of the reasons why human beings have been so industrious and so successful is that we have our division of labor, that we realized early as a species that we can get a lot more done if the people who are good at certain things lean into those things while others do what they're good at, and then we trade and barter goods and services. Without that access to be able to trade and barter goods and services with people who have like millennia of know-how better than us, people who have invented these goods and services, we only gained access to that 26 years before Mass Effect 1. So we only had 26 years of possible learning from those more advanced Citadel races technology.
Yeah. And I know that there, that definitely, as soon as we get a little bit of that tech, it's going to bring in that level of humanity of where now it's like, okay, we've learned this one thing. Let's see what we can do and run with it. But yeah, I'm starting to see a little bit of the cracks in the writing, but I still like it.
But it was also, and we'll get into it later, like the timing of it being necessary for some of the greater writing themes throughout the series. However, again, you know, only 26 years worth of trade deals, of research agreements, et cetera, et cetera. Now, okay, I'm going to go fully nerd here and draw a real world parallel and compare it with Mass Effect lore to paint a picture. To paint a picture of how advanced and how quickly advanced humanity became. It's only about 300 to 320 years after the first automobiles were invented on Earth that Mass Effect 1 started. That's only 320-ish years after the first cars were invented on Earth. Now, I bring this up because we have a good point of reference for the Asari here. For the Asari, they made their first equivalent of automobiles about 30,000 years before the current modern era. So there's a gap of about 27,420 years there, but between the Asari developing their first automobiles and then eventually flying faster than the speed of light. So gap between those two events in Asari history of about 27,420 years. About that. Because they develop FTL travel in 580 BC, and we know that. So, 27,420 year gap. For humans, again, that gap, 300 to 320 years.
Okay, yeah. I get that, but I think there's kind of a key thing about a key difference between humans and Asari that would kind of play into why that math is not a good equal comparison.
Okay, allow me to go full actually, because I did the math here too. Out of fairness, you know, it was like, what if we break that down into lifespans? How many generations passed for each race between those two hallmark inventions? For the Asari, it's about 27 generations that have passed. They live to more than 1,000 years old, about 1,000 years old. So that's about 27 generations for the Asari. For humans, this one is harder to tell because human lifespans have varied so greatly in different regions of the world since the 1880s when cars were invented. But we can take averages. So according to Statista, the average human life expectancy in the United States was only about 40 years old in 1880. Now, before you start thinking, well, hold on a second, in 1880, people were living older than 40. Yes, that's true. But infant mortality was vastly bringing it down. So it's really hard to find a number about life expectancy that does not incorporate infant mortality. It's really hard to get that number for the people who grew past infancy and how long did they live on average. So even if we take that lower number, just to be conservative, we take that lower number for human life expectancy. And even if we assume that it never improved from 1880 to 2183, let's assume it never improved, despite the fact that we know it does improve, we would still be left with about 8 generations of humans existing between the invention of cars and the discovery of FTL travel. So again, for comparison, 27 generations of Asari, 8 generations of humans on the conservative end. It could have been fewer generations than that of humans because human lifespan increased during those years.
I retort with gotta go fast.
Gotta go fast. Humans are sanic. So, you know, just taking just this figure, and again, it could be totally BS because I'm trying to draw like a parallel between real life stuff and real history and fictional Mass Effect lore. But just taking this, we can fairly conclude that during the relative industrial and modern ages for both races, humans advanced more than three times faster than the Asari.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is actually a really awesome and well-researched comparison. The math that you did on here is beautiful. My accounting heart appreciates this.
Thank you.
And I do agree. There is a level of like of human in this that I see, that once we get our hands on something, we get the new, we get the shiny, especially when it comes to transportation. I feel like that's one of our biggest things that we love tinkering with, you know, the fast cars, breaking the sound speed, going to new places and things that we haven't been to before. I know that once we get this in our current real world, we are going to want to do it. We see this right now with everybody wanting to travel to space for 5 freaking minutes. You know, it's like as soon as we get this capability, we are all going to be wanting to do this. And so I could see that, especially with something as FTL or going to Mars, going off planet, is going to be something that a lot of money, a lot of private investors are going to be going towards. I don't know if the Asari have that same level of drive.
Correct. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but we do know that their culture of sit back and watch really contributes here. Alan brings up a good point about, do we know how long the Salarians took to get to this point? I haven't been able to find definitive dates for comparison for the Salarians. We do know that they were around after the Protheans were, or for the Prothean era, because of what Javik says, right, about them being primitive lizard people who ate flies. So they were around. They were primitive. We do know that they discovered the Citadel after the Asari, and we know that I believe they formed the Council in 580, was it? 500? I think it was 500 BC, and that counts as the year zero for Galactic Standard. So it took them tens of thousands of years to discover the Citadel.
Wow. Okay.
We also know, though, that humans were around, like Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon hunters were around during the time of the Protheans because of my favorite side planet, Elatania, which... I'm not wearing the Elatania shirt today. I'm wearing the Antarum shirt today. But yeah, so it's not as easily, you can't draw a parallel as easily, I think, just because of the lack of information we have on the Salarians.
Okay, well, while I wish that we could draw more information, I think right now would be a good spot for us to take a little bit of a mid break. And when we get back, we can continue talking about the Asari and other ideas that we have for this.
Yes, ma'am. Let's go to the mid-break.
Hey, baseball fans. It's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
A healthy life starts with great sleep. Wake refreshed with Avocado's GOTS certified organic green mattress, delivering breathable, back-loving support, natural materials from Avocado's own sustainable wool and latex farms, easy financing, a one-year sleep trial, and deep, restorative slumbers. Organic sleep awaits at avocadomattress.com.
We have beef, we have bacon, we have beer, the foods of my people.
Young men have funny ideas of what Asari are like. I blame the extranet and computer games.
Rex?
Shepard.
Grunt?
Shepard.
Rex? Grunt?
Okay, and here we are in the middle of the show where we will read out your five-star reviews if you leave them for us. And we actually have one new five-star review from Fluffy McNutters. Fluffy says, knows more about Mass Effect than the devs. Whoa, that's a huge claim, and I don't think that's true at all. But Fluffy says, if you want to know everything about Mass Effect, this is the place to be. N7 knows so much about Mass Effect that he's the leading authority in Mass Effect. That's not true. I devote a lot of time, more than the average bear, to researching these topics. But Fluffy, thank you so much for your support of the Lorecast. Even if I am probably realistically not as impressive as you have made me out to be. But thank you nonetheless. We have seen a lot of very kind comments from people on the episode 200. I'm going to read a review here from Scuba Steve on the Celebrating Lorecast Greatest Moments episode 200 on Spotify. Scuba Steve says, congrats on 200 episodes. This podcast has become a weekly tradition for me during the workday. I'd like to pose a question. In your professional opinion, who do you think would win in a fight, the Reapers or the Flood from Halo? All the best for future episodes and looking forward to episode 300. Okay, Genesis, easy answer for me. Reapers.
Yeah, the particle beam that a Reaper can produce is pretty damaging. Like, there's not much that can fight against that.
Also, what are the Flood gonna do once they crawl onto a Reaper?
Yeah, I mean, like, try and dismantle it from the inside, but even still, it's not gonna work.
Don't the Flood thrive on organics?
You're really testing the girl who's only played Halo like 3 times, buddy.
Well, moving on. Thank you, Scuba Steve, and thank you, Fluffy McNutters, for the kind words. We also have a sound effect quiz, isn't that right, Jen?
We do, and this is probably one of the most obscene lines in the OG trilogy. So guard the young one's ears. I can play the audio clip here. I also sent it to you in case it doesn't come through clearly. But here we go.
Those Asari Hanar porn games they sell in Shin Akiba are really nasty.
Nice. That is the Solarian game broker dealer guy with a table on the Zakara Ward. I can't remember which level in Mass Effect 2, right?
Congratulations. There we go. Exactly.
Okay. I remember that guy because of how excited he gets about that one, like, what is it? It's like a chess strategy or war strategy game he's talking about. He gets super excited about it. But yes, that's awesome. I don't remember the porn game discussion though. I don't remember him talking about that. That's hilarious. Okay, and we also have a...
Scans have found something.
Planet card, Terra Nova, which helps explain this population boom that we've been talking about. Okay, here it is. Terra Nova was one of the Class 1 colonization prospects discovered by the first wave Alliance surveys in 2150. It was the second human extrasolar colony and the first beyond the Charon Mass Relay. It currently has the highest population of any Alliance colony. Though banded by a harsh equatorial desert, areas closer to the poles are temperate. The pace of development was modest until extensive deposits of platinum were discovered in the 2170s. This rare metal, required in the clean-burning hydrogen fuel cells that power private vehicles, attracted a quote-unquote platinum rush of immigrants and investment from throughout Alliance space. In the past 12 years, Terra Nova has seen a 30% rise in population, and growth does not appear to be slowing.
Shepard,
We've arrived. The crew is waiting.
We've arrived on Terra Nova, where there is undoubtedly a housing crisis. Holy crap, 30% rise in population. I'm guessing that's year over year.
Yeah, that's got to be. But wow. And I guess maybe this helps to explain about what it was taking like 150 people every day. And I guess that many people could be leaving Earth every day and then eventually making their way to Terra Nova after, you know, traveling around and going to a couple different other planets and seeing things first. Because I'm thinking one ship going every day for 150 people is quite a lot. But, you know, hundreds of ships leaving off planet every day could sustain that type of population.
I think it was actually 300 some every day, but it actually says here in the planet card that we probably can't expect a linear growth because the pace of development was modest until those platinum deposits were discovered in the 2170s. So it's probably even more people per day than that. Yeah. And it does sound like it was a gold rush kind of thing that happened with Terra Nova, which is really cool history. Helps us to understand, I guess, a little bit more, but still a massive, massive logistical feat to be able to do that. But all right, we have new patrons to shout out. We have a new Tier 5 patron, Unfortunate Benefactor. Thank you. I think we've discovered who's behind the initiative. And am I reading this right? We have a new patron named Leave a Voicemail. I'm busy calibrating.
That's what they have listed as their Patreon name. So that's what I put on the thing.
Okay. All right. Good. We also have to shout out our existing tier fives, William, Superfly 440, Retrobot, Lieutenant Tucino, Curacy, Ed Boy, and Draco. Thank you all for your continued support. And of course we have Commander Shrinky Chef, our tier 6 patron, who has brought you this episode. All right, and with that, let's get back to the rest of the show.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple thousand dollars in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/hiddentruecrime.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting.
It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively at a Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
After time adrift among open stars, along tides of light and through shoals of dust, I will return to where I began.
Solarian reproduction different. Very little sex drive. If intended to try human, would try you.
Ow, my pancreas.
Okay, Jin, we have to answer a couple of questions that we have kind of... we've laid the groundwork for just how fast humanity was expanding, but how and why, I think, are the biggest questions that are lingering here. We touched on it a little bit earlier. I wanted to talk about how culture has a huge role to play. As we know that humans are seen as this ambitious, industrious, and adaptable race. But Asari were known as playing the long game, as the Codex puts it. They prefer very slow change, and only after long periods of observation and study. So they're like the bureaucratic species. So humans are these great
risk takers in comparison, and perhaps that allowed their technology to evolve 3 times faster than that of the greatest economy in the galaxy.
I fully agree with that portion, because we have seen technology booms like this several times throughout our real world human history. One new idea or a spark of inspiration can be the starting points of leaps and bounds. And so I think that that's kind of where the writers took this direction, is the fact that once we get a hand on new technology, we are going to run with it and run faster than light speed at it.
Yeah. And I also think that there's something to say here about the fact that not every venture succeeds, but that humans learn from the failures, that you always learn from the failures. And it seems like Asari are more averse to failure at all. So they don't take these risks. It's also arguable that Turian culture, the rigidity and military-like stratification of it, has limited the speed of innovation and their advancement compared with human ingenuity. And we can see this example even within cultures on Earth, where we have societies governed by authoritarian rule. Those inevitably run into what we call brain drain. Great thinkers flocking to areas with more freedom, often those areas with more freedom giving birth to more great thinkers and great inventors and great artists and musicians, etc. So maybe the same was true for humanity comparatively in the 22nd century.
I could definitely see that, especially when your culture is very militaristic, like the Turians are. Theirs was all about making better ships and making better weaponry, making advancements in that portion of it, not necessarily the level of exploration and going out there and doing, you know, colonization missions, things like that. They were more focused on, let me create things to protect what we already have, not necessarily going out to conquest.
You and I both play Civilization. The Turians focused on military and production, whereas humanity focused on like production and science. That seems to be the difference. The Volus were clearly focusing on money.
And the Asari kind of focused more on religion and
culture. Yeah. Look at that. Yeah. Look at how well that parallels. You know, we also hear from Morden that humans have greater variation in their biodiversity, and that makes them a good candidate species for medical studies as a control group. So I wonder if that had any impact on variations of individual psychology, because I do firmly believe that physiology, differences in physiology can lead to differences in psychology, right? The two are interconnected. So I wonder, did the greater physical diversity among humans ultimately result in greater diversity of ideas in the scientific and industrial realms?
I absolutely agree with that, because every human is so individual and unique, and the way that we think and process things is different. And so we can even be looking at the same set of data and interpret it in different ways. If it's, you know, 1 + 1 is going to equal 2. But if we're looking at algorithms or different data sets and comparing and contrasting, we can interpret that data differently and think about that. And I mean, even from you and I think our brains work very, very differently when it comes to idea formation. And we are also physically very, very different. And I think that has a part to play in it, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that could even go back to how much the climates on Earth vary themselves, because human beings adopted and evolved to fit the climates that they lived in. So I think it's clear that human physiology helped them advance faster than, say, races like the Elcor, who have evolved to move slowly because of their high gravity on Dacuna. And human physiology has also helped humans colonize faster than like the Volus, who are not that militaristic, but they also need ammonia atmospheres and or high pressure suits. So that's like a much higher maintenance cost just to be able to diversify and colonize. And most planets are just not going to accommodate that.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely don't have any ammonia atmospheres over here, so they're not going to be able to travel. Like, there's no point in traveling into our space. Yeah.
I love the fact that the writers wrote so many of these, like, caveats in there. Because they did. Clearly, the debate over how humanity was able to rapidly expand, clearly this was a focal point in the writing room. And between writers, between different teams on the game, I'm sure that they went back and forth over this. But if anything, I'm willing to bet that the writers intended that the diversity of thought, of ideology, of cultures, of behavior intrinsic to humans, that's what made them so much more adaptable as a species. And that adaptability is what allowed them to prosper so quickly in so many environments. And if you take that to a very like ideological realm, diversity of your team being a great strength to your survival, that is a super Mass Effect like idea that we're celebrating the diversity of our team.
Absolutely, because we see that in every single game, because it's not all humans. We have a vast majority of the species on the Normandy and on the Tempest. We have diversity in all four games. It's never going to be just a human game.
Oh, right. And how much of the fan base wants to play as an alien in the next game, right? But it's ironic then that humans have the greatest level of physiological variation among the different species, and so that could have provided them with a natural advantage in terms of adapting to and expanding so quickly. We should also address that humanity had a great deal of privilege bestowed upon it because of those Mars archives. It was the first planet beyond Earth. You know, some races did not get so lucky. Others arguably got luckier, like the Asari, who were coached. But, you know, humanity outstripping them is why I brought up that comparison with the Asari earlier. To break the fourth wall, and I think we might disagree here, but to break the fourth wall, I think it was a strategic choice from the writers to include humans in as many areas as possible in the Mass Effect universe, because that meant giving players a chance to see as many human-alien interactions as possible. So maybe the idea from the writers was to make an alien landscape feel relatable. Maybe the same reason we can only play as human, because humans are that window to relatability for us. They are... Playing as a human gives us a window through which to perceive the alien world.
Mm-hmm. I actually agree with you on this one. I think that humans need to be in the spaces so that way we have somebody to relate to. But they're not in every single space. They are where they could actually be. You know, we don't see humans during the Battle of Thessia, you know, other than stupid freaking Kai Lang, but that's a whole different story, you know. But we don't see humans where they wouldn't belong.
True. We don't see them on Sirkesh. We don't see, you know, we don't actually go to a lot of the different council races' homeworlds. I wish we got to go to Palavin, but we closest we get is Minae.
Yeah, and we didn't have humans there.
We didn't have humans
in Chichanka.
Yep. But it shouldn't surprise anyone that being so intrinsically, you know, intricately involved in the galactic economy, that we do find humans on the Citadel. We do find humans on Omega, because humans also like being criminals. So I don't know. And I think it's also, you know, again, a gameplay tactic. We can put humans as the bad guys in different factions if we spread them here, here, and here.
Yeah.
So let's, you know, Shrinky Shep asked us, how could the Mass Effect writing team have approached expansion or advancement differently? And I thought that he had an interesting idea when he said, realistically, the writers probably should have had humanity already on the scene for 2 to 3 times as many years by the start of Mass Effect 1, given the population numbers and other factors. What do you think of that?
Okay, so on this point, yes, the population has expanded rapidly, and that could have used a little bit more time to explain that. But from a story standpoint, I like it being set when it was. If we were further removed from the First Contact War, there wouldn't have been such a racial tension in the beginning. We wouldn't hear the stories from Presley or Ashley about family members that they knew in the war. It would have been distant relatives in the past, not someone that they had known as kids. There's more impact that way. So many of our favorite storylines would have been completely different if more time had passed between the discovery of the relay and when the game starts.
Yeah, there would have been more time to heal wounds, emotional, physical, what have you, political even. And some of those wounds are the source of a lot of the greatest stories and conflicts in the game. So I agree with you there. Shrinky Shep also offers another interesting alternative to consider, that the writers should have, quote, made humanity more of an unestablished newcomer, which probably would have given the games more of a classic sci-fi flavor. I like thinking about this, of how Mass Effect could have been different if humans were such a newcomer that it was like, you know, we had only been on the galactic stage for like 10 years, if that, or 20 years even, and you barely found humans anywhere else. Like, for some reason, that makes me think of different sci-fi universes, like even like Star Wars. Like, in Star Wars, humans do really seem like the minority, right?
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that most of the major characters are humans, whenever they go places, especially in the older Star Wars films, there's so many aliens of different species everywhere else that you get the sense that humans are not at all like this urgent sense of power. Now, obviously, the clones are all human, arguably. Yeah. But I also think of The Expanse. I think of The Fifth Element, which you are well acquainted with.
Yes. Oh, so it's like, for me, though, I don't know. I don't actually agree on this point, though. I don't like the idea, because humans are not as respected and we don't hold a lot of power. We are a minority, but we don't see that because we are mainly involved in the human aspects of space. We travel to human colonies. We travel to the human embassies. We travel on humanitarian missions. It's very anthropocentric. We don't have a specter. We don't have a seat on the council. And we are widely ignored when trying to explain that, while still in children in the council's eyes, we are speaking the truth, but we're still babies, so they don't listen. We don't hold power. And from a gamer aspect of that, I kind of like the fact that it didn't feel like another Star Trek retelling. You brought up Star Wars, I'm going to bring it to Star Trek. This isn't us exploring the final frontier, meeting new aliens and learning to communicate with them. This is more of the next step beyond that, establishing the foothold and an identity within the galactic space.
That's a great point, and I like that. I like that idea that we are presented with the great opportunity to have a chip on our shoulder in the very beginning. And something that I've picked up from when developers have talked about the unexpected outpouring of love for alien squad mates like Garrus and Tally, I would go further to say that I would venture to guess the developers did not expect the flood of empathy that human players, obviously, human players felt for the aliens, which perhaps they were set up to feel in conflict with. Looking at you, yeah. Sarah Mansers.
Sarah Mansers, yes. But also for like Tally, I think that she's got so many characteristics that we can identify with that makes it easier for people to gravitate towards that. you know. So yes, they obviously have human characteristics because the game was written by humans.
Well, really? I thought there was at least one or two Turians on the staff there. But yeah, no, I think, and I think that that was just part of the focus from the very beginning, right? I think the one sheet explainer on Mass Effect was Jack Reacher in space or something like that, right? It was something, it was something, what's the name of the guy from 24?
Jack Bauer.
Jack Bauer, that's what it was. And the one sheet explainer was Jack Bauer in space, being Commander Shepard being Jack Bauer. So yeah, I'm not at all surprised that with kind of a Tom Clancy-esque feel for how the game was even originally pitched under Casey Hudson, that they would go with a human-centric approach. Now comes the question of, should the writers have approached it differently? Or is Mass Effect's pace of humanity being the top dog, ultimate OG badass appropriate?
Again, I don't think it was intended for humans to be so badass. I think that we just think that way because Shepard is human and they are the goat. But there is no Shepard without Vicarian. And I guess the other squad mates too.
Fair, but the numbers don't lie, right? Within 26 years, the human military is set to outpace the Turian hierarchy, who are the galactic peacekeepers. Within 26 years, like, the human economy is not nearly as big as the Asari economy, but it's sizable enough to warrant political power with their own embassy, and then after Mass Effect 1, their own counselor. So they are gobbling up political power very quickly, like 26 years. I mean, that's within one Salarian lifetime, right? More than remembers before humans were around. So it's wild to think that more than remembers that. So I understand when people have this where they poke holes and say, how could realistically humans spread that fast? However, I also think that it was a necessary detail to set up a lot of the conflict. I don't think the writers could have approached human expansion throughout the Milky Way any differently without also changing so many elements that were central to the games that we love. Would it have been the same game? Like, for example, how many times do we run into aliens who are resentful or distrustful of the new humans on the block? How many times does humanity's status as newcomer actually play into how Shepard is received somewhere? How many times does that tension lead to conflicts that we as the players resolve or try to resolve and fail?
Yeah, there we go. Now we're back in sync. Because I agree with this. I fully agree.
Like, Cerberus's whole shtick wouldn't work if aliens were not wary of humanity. If humanity had been around long enough, everyone kind of learned to play nice and put aside their differences. You know, like the Elusive Man and Cerberus, they feed off of this distrust to try and paint humanity as the victims, being surrounded by these vicious alien opponents ready to invade the Sol system, right?
Was I accidentally taking a pro-Cerberus stance on this episode? What's going on with me?
No. What I'm saying is that basically Cerberus thrives and lives under this umbrella of faux victimhood. Man, where have we heard that before? But that's what they do. And that's how they recruit. Cerberus could not recruit if there was not as much tension, not as much distrust between the alien races and humanity.
Okay. Yeah. I guess my stance of, you know, humans are not as powerful as we think they are, that's not very pro-Cerberus. Okay. I'm good. I'm safe.
I'd say it's more Ashley. Humanity's status is so interwoven with so many of the other themes in this game and these games that I'm just not sure that it's possible to radically change it, at least in the original trilogy, without scrapping huge chunks. Because just take a look at the Andromeda. Like, there's not nearly as many human-alien tensions there.
Right. And even if we 500 years have passed. Well, no, because they were all in sleep. They were all asleep in deep freeze. So actually, no time has passed for them. Also, it's like, I don't think that bumping the timeline up any further would have made it the game as engaging. I fully agree that it's like we needed this timeline to be the way that it was to create some of those original tensions, to create the things, and for the storyline that we all fell in love with to be as it was. If we start adding more time in between events, it would lessen the impact because it's not fresh, it's not new. Even though there are events that happened hundreds of years ago that still have an effect in the game, those are the things where that effect is still ongoing. Because, I mean, I just thought of the Genophage. That happened a really long time ago, but the effects of that war, the effects of that virus, of the genetic recoding, we still see that today.
And, I was just thinking about world building events, like you're talking about the First Contact War being the largest world building event for humanity, because pretty much all of human history is like the same as our real history up until 2069, right? Or no, I'm sorry, before that, the Second American Civil War, I think, is the earliest human historical diversion of events in Mass Effect's timeline. So it's pretty much the same until that. So like these things are huge for world building, where we can look to like our own people, right? Humans, and say, how is humanity different in Mass Effect? Oh, okay. Well, we got this First Contact War. It's still fresh in people's minds. Boom. Now you have a unique source of lore. So, did humanity expand too rapidly? I don't know. I think the games did a pretty good job explaining it. There's certainly some plot holes, like we've pointed out, but I think I want it this way.
I, too, want it this way. The logistics are a little off, but it's also that I can go with the game. There is a way to get that many people off planet within this short of a time frame.
Just send them individually through the mass relay. No ship, just person. All right, and we're here. That's what happens to the bad boys. I think that's all we got on this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, make sure to send Commander Shrinky Shep a special thank you. We are back to our regular lore episodes next week, where we have more corporations. We have more important storylines that have not been discussed yet, and more important characters have yet to talk about. So keep in touch for the next episode. That'll be next week. Again, we did have to take last week off. Feel very bad about that one. But we are happy to be back at it. And Jin, until next week, how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can definitely hit me up on the Discord, or if you just like hearing my voice, I do have two other podcasts, the Two Girls, One Ship podcast, where we analyze, rate, and review all that the world of video game romances has to offer. We just started our Dragon Age Veilguard season, so if you want to learn more about the Veilguard romances, come give those episodes a listen. And also on the Cyberpunk Lorecast, where Toasty and I explore the foundations of the past, the state of Night City today, and the news of the future for all things cyberpunk. We just wrapped up a three-part series on Petrochem, a megacorp within cyberpunk.
That sounds super intriguing. I'm going to have to listen to that. I have a longer 45 minutes, hour drive coming up. I will have to put that on. Also, wanted to drop a line. If anyone that's listening to this is a former writer for Mass Effect or knows one, maybe drop a line with them, because we would love to get in touch with some of them specifically to talk about Dark Energy. We're looking into a Dark Energy episode for the Mass Effect Lorecast, trying to compile as much as we possibly know that has been publicly released about where that plotline came from and where it was headed before it was scrapped. And if we could get in touch with some of the people who helped write the series, they probably know better than us. So we'd love to be able to speak to them and to do so on a laid-back fan podcast as a 13-year post-mortem might be fun. So anyway, you can get a hold of me on Blue Sky on Twitch. I haven't streamed in quite a while. That's because I have a baby. And streaming with a newborn is pretty difficult, if not impossible. So I haven't even tried. But you can follow me on Twitch. I promise I will get back to streaming, or find me on the Discord. Any social media or gaming channel I have, it's going to be titled at N7 The Legend. So that's all we got for this week, Spectres. Until next time, I guess the lesson is don't expand too rapidly. And if you do, have the military to back it up. All right. Take care, Spectres. We should go. Thanks for listening to the Mass Effect Lorecast. Reach out to us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Discord, Patreon, or email us at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.
Join us next week for more lore. Same space, same time. Or check out our live streams at twitch.tv/masseffectlorecast.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting.
It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively to Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.